Welcome to Midrats with Sal from Commander Salamander and Eagle One from Eagle Speak at Sea or Shore, your home for a discussion of national security issues and all things maritime. And welcome aboard, everybody. I am the aforementioned Sal, and congratulations on joining us for a end of January free-for-all. That's right. Mark and I, we do not have any guests today. It's just the two of us. We're going to be looking not just at the waterfront, but maybe a few things ashore, those things that are breaking above the background noise and the national security arena. And as we like to do with our free-for-all formats, if you are with us live, if you go ahead and go to the bottom of the show page, that's where you will find the chat room. We've already got some folks there standing by. And if you have some observations you'd like to share during the course of the show, or if there's a question you would like to ask the two of us, that's a great place to put it in there, and we'll jump right on it when it comes in. And as always, if you're with us live, you look at the top of the show page, there is the studio number. If you're feeling brave and want to give us a call, you can call us there too. But besides that, good afternoon, my illustrious co-host. How are you doing today?
I'm doing well, Sal. Thank you for asking.
Well, it's we were doing a little bit of a pre-show here that in the starting of the show caught up with us, but that's live. That's a live show for the what it's worth. But we were talking about, you know, some of the things to talk about today. It's like, you know, where do you start? There's so much going on, and we've had some dedicated shows on various topics. But I guess one thing to start with, if you look at the four areas that are absorbing most of the digital print, so to speak, in this arena, it's the ongoing, going on year three almost, of the Russia-Ukrainian war, Europe's response to that. We have the Hamas-Israel conflict that is going on since the 7th of October. And what started as part of that, but I think it's fair to say, is evolving, if it's not already, into a separate challenge. That's the war on shipping emanating from Iran and her proxies. And, of course, there's everything going on in Westpac with Taiwan that continues to evolve. And I guess for those that are joining us live, they've probably been soaking in the news of the day. And the latest news of the day, I'll just use a reference point, Christina Wong, who does a really good job making sure that the numbers are right. She put out today, and I think it's right, because the DoD spokesman said there were more than 161. The way Christina's numbers are looking at is U.S. forces, mostly in Syria and Iraq, but also, as we'll talk about here in a second, in other places, since the Hamas-Israel war kicked off at the end of the first week in October, there have been 170 attacks on Americans, 25 injured, one critically injured. There's been quite a few, though they haven't given us a number, that has suffered from TBI, which when you're being attacked by missiles, those are big explosions. That'll knock your bell for a bit. And today at a place called Tower 22, which is in the northeast corner of Jordan, near where Iraq, Syria, and Jordan come together, is a place called Tower 22 that I believe is at least partially staffed by California National Guardsmen, where we had three people killed in an attack in the last 24 hours. And a lot of people, and I think some of our prior guests, we just have mentioned the fact that it was just a matter of time that whether you're ashore or at our ships at sea, that when the enemy launches a bunch of stuff at you, regardless of how dumb or primitive it is, you've got to be right every time. They only need to be right once. And it looks like they finally hit what they've been aiming at for a while.
Yeah. And I mean, I don't want anybody to die foolishly, and I'm not sure what these guys were doing where they are. But you know, I think somebody on X, formerly Twitter, I think you have to say that, right? You have to say formerly Twitter now, all the time. I think pointed out that the one of the problems with fighting off these missile attacks that have been taking place in the Red Sea is that, and just exactly what you said and what our guest last week said, is that, you know, if you're playing defense, you have to be right all the time. Just what you said, you have to be right all the time. And if the Houthis succeed on hitting a U.S. Navy ship with one of their, whatever, however primitive or however sophisticated weapons they have, that's a major victory for them. And we just have to be really conscious of the fact that our guys are engaging in war, whether we call it war or escorting tankers and other vessels through the Red Sea. This is the real thing now. And I don't know how long the U.S. can sit by and watch people being shot at, wounded, injured, killed, and spending vast sums of money, really, with every missile we shoot, and the Brits are doing it too, to defend merchant shipping without some kind of declaration that we're going to go after the people behind all this. And we all know who those people are. They're the Iranians. And, you know, are we going to do anything about it? Or are we going to continue to pretend like this is just the Houthis doing this all by themselves?
And obviously, whatever we've done right now, it's there's no deterring here. There's just punishing. How you get from punishment to deterrent, I don't know. But if you don't want them to keep shooting at us, you have to degrade their capability, which is finding out where their weapons are stored, and you have to stop new weapons from getting to them. And nobody's used the B word, blockade, to actually do a blockade. And there have been a few people who have been talking this about a new approach to Iran and things that now that we have Americans dead, that they're going to have to do. I don't know. Secretary of State Blinken and the National Security Advisor Sullivan, they've kind of made their career back to the Obama days on finding a way to get whatever that secret sauce they're trying to get out of the Iranians to do that. Could the present administration change to a little more robust structure against at least Iranian proxies? Absolutely it can. I just don't know whether the Blinken and Sullivan team are the right people to make that pivot. I'm sure there are people in the Biden administration who would like to make that pivot, but they're not the ones making the decisions right now. I guess if directed to, they would, but I don't see how you get through that wall of the people that they've put in positions that really, really believe that a rapprochement, as the fancy people say, with Iran is the best way to prevent them from getting nuclear weapons and to create other positive effects down the road. I don't agree with them, but it's a position. I have a feeling, at least from the outside, they're going to get additional pressure to tighten things down. And yes, the three individuals killed were not killed by the Houthi, but they're all Iranian proxies. One thing that I think we need to be careful about, and at least under the present administration, I don't think this is going to be an option, but you never know, is going feet dry over Iran. That's not a step I think anybody wants to take. I don't think we're there yet. We got lots of proxies to go through, and there are things that we can do before getting too much feet dry in Iran. Like the one thing that I saw today, and I'm sure there's some good intel officer that has the truth on that, is I'd encourage the listeners, if they're not aware of it, go ahead and Google Shahid Bagheri. That's Bagheri. There also has another ship, Shahid something else I can't pronounce and I can't read my writing, so I don't want to spell it out to you. But Bagheri will get you there. What they've done is actually something that we've talked about us doing, but we haven't converted a couple of their merchant ships into a smooth version, a modernized version of what the Atlantic Conveyor would have done. It's a helicopter and a drone carrier that is actually not part of the Iranian Navy proper. It's the Iranian Revolutionary Guard Corps Navy. Once we get through clawing through some of their proxies, I think those platforms that, again, a smart intel guy could probably tell us, and I think it's probably true, may have been involved in, if not intel gathering for the Houthis, but maybe some of those mysterious drone strikes on ships off of Oman, between Oman and Pakistan, might have originated from there. Those would be interesting things to have them no longer be seaworthy, I guess would be a polite way of saying it.
Yeah, I don't really want anybody to go to war with Iran. I just want Iran to stop doing what they're doing. And sometimes you don't want to do what you have to do. And I think that this is becoming that point. We cannot allow this type of behavior. I mean, it's bad enough that this is revealing what we all know anyway, that ships that are fairly close to shore are going to be subject to missile attacks, and they don't have to be sophisticated weapon systems to go after those ships. We saw it with the Israelis when they somebody fired what appears to be a Chinese C-802 missile at their ship. It kind of missed the Israeli ship and hammered a merchant ship further out. I think did some damage to the Israeli ship. But this is something that we keep talking about, and we can't bring we have to be really careful about bringing our carriers too close to the shore. They make great targets. We are betting that the DDGs we have can continue to fend off the attacks. And I'm always reminded of the scene in Red Storm Rising, where after you've fended off a whole bunch of attacks, and the next wave comes, and you've already gone Winchester. So it's a problem. We have limited magazine capacity on the ships that are out there, and if that is a concern. I guess we can keep rotating ships in and out, but we better have a better way of rearming those things. And I'm not sure, can't be done at sea. So I know they're trying to work on that, but these are challenges that we need to face up to and deal with. So far, we've been lucky and very good. I got to commend the crews of all the ships involved, that they've been able to do such a good job fighting down these drones and missiles and ballistic missiles and all that. And the air crews from the carrier that have been engaging in the day's version of a scud hunt, trying to find the launchers and equipment of the Houthis. They've apparently taken out quite a few of them, but I'm wondering how fast the Houthis can recycle their equipment. How much stuff did Iran actually give these clowns?
Yeah, how many dows does it take to replenish it? That's where that some type of blockade against the Houthi coast. I don't know how much they're able to smuggle in overland, but as any logistics guy can tell you, when you've got to move heavy things in volume, it's got to be done by sea. You can only do so much by ashore unless you're using rails. And this is something, we're going into our 14th year here. We've been talking about this for over a decade, but this is another data point that popped into my mind while you were speaking a couple minutes ago. Small conflicts give you big hints about what you need to focus on for the next war. And if you look at modern warship design, was there a threat from the air? Yeah, there was. Besides planning for the regiment-sized backfire attacks in the North Atlantic, which is what the good old Tom Kack and the F-404 was supposed to bleed them out before they came in. And then we got our Aegis ships to do that. But one looking at consistent volume of fire that would be coming inbound. And so if we are reaching a time where even fourth tier competitors or hostile forces can flood the air with things, how does that make us think about not just the designs of our ships, but when you look at I'm going to channel John Conrad here. Who's going to defend all of our merchant vessels that we're going to be relying on going west? And, you know, take a snapshot of what the Houthis and the Iranians are doing right now and put 5 more years of R&D and production and modifications on top of that. And what are you looking at in 2029? That could be very, very interesting. It's like what you're looking at in 1936 versus what you're looking at in 1941, because we're not the only ones that are looking at it. Anybody who was looking at trying to make access to the seas either unaffordable or ineffective or inefficient, the flying lawnmowers still need to be shot down, and if they're mixed in with higher capable assets as well, it really can run through what ships that you have out to escort there. And that's what people with fleet design need to do, not just in the U.S., but in other nations, is look at the ships you're presently building and ask yourself, is this really designed for what we think is coming, that we need to modify it, maybe do another flight? Or was this all based upon theory that didn't quite plan out like we thought?
Yeah, it's a good question. I think, you know, you go back in history and the you look at the effect the first torpedo boats had on ship design. You know, you begin to get these huge battleships and stuff with those torpedo blisters and all that good stuff. You know, do you change your design to meet the flying lawnmower? Do you change to meet the heavier threat? You know, I don't know. I think, you know, we're relying on technology, to modern technology, to beat weapons that are pretty simple, and apparently, you know, we're good at it. But there is always that risk that we're not, you know, all it takes is one, and you know, it would be, as somebody pointed out in the chat room, you know, the CNN effect is in place. We've already lost. You know, we lose 3 guys in Jordan, and we lose 2 SEALs trying to board a dhow, which was apparently transporting weapons to the Houthis. So, you know, this is war. I mean, I don't, you know, they can call it whatever they want, but this is war. I mean, somebody's interfering with your ability to do whatever it is you want to do. That becomes more than just a nuisance. Then that's what we used to call war. I don't know what goes in the minds of the administration when they're dealing with this. You know, are we going to send another strong letter to the Iranians saying, "Oh, don't do this," or "Well, this time we really mean it"? I mean, I remember a number of red lines we were drawing in the sand. If X happened, you know, we were going to really do something, and nothing ever panned out in those cases.
I do think it's kind of refreshing, and you and I are old enough that we can remember such a time. I think what's been interesting is what's been lacking in any of the conversation about what's going on here is the United Nations. The only thing you're really reading about the United Nations right now is how the schools that they had in Gaza were just terrorist training camps. So if that part of the post-war dream, I mean, it died a long time ago. I saw it die in Afghanistan when it was just ridiculous. But I think that it's not only dead, it's been dug up, gibbeted, stabbed again, and it's being left out there. So they're do we return back to the era that nobody's going to look at the UN to do anything, except maybe after the fact. Individual nations and their friends are just going to have to step forward and do something. And going back to the ship design bit for a second, I got to give him credit. And Trent Telenko, who I joined with John Conrad on one of John's spaces over on X, but he had me thinking this weekend, which is always appreciated, is he made a point about, again, fourth-rate Yemen power has everybody thinking about what was once literally science fiction conjecture, anti-ship ballistic missile. And we can assume that what they're using is, you know, mod zero, generation zero. I mean, these are not advanced anti-ship ballistic missiles. But the stream bags that we threw off the front of a cruiser within a couple of decades was the Battle of Midway. So these things can advance pretty fast. And he made a good point that if you have your major ships, which for most of our allies is a frigate, but let's just go ahead and draw a line, you know, your 7,000-ton frigate north, if it doesn't have an anti-ship ballistic missile capability, you know, can it really defend itself? Can, you know, if you have a purpose built, like there's an interesting quote maybe I'll bring up later about the Australia's Hunter class frigates coming on board. It's supposed to be anti-submarine warfare frigates. But when you're a small Navy, you only have a few units. They've got to be ready to dance at the party they get invited to. They're not able to pick the DJ and the dance floor. They're not big enough to do that. So if you have one of those ships, 7,000 tons or higher, are you really building it for what you're being hinted is the threat that you're probably going to face, or one of the threats you're going to face? Or are you trying to just design a ship for what best fits the vignette personnel at the moment decided was their preferred war they would like to fight? So had me thinking a lot about that. You know, miniaturization is great. The modern version of Aegis and other radars are pretty darn impressive. Mark 41 VLS, Mark 57 VLS, the advances we've made in the standard missiles recently, especially for us and our allies, is impressive. But is it impressive enough to be able to answer that in the affirmative here in 5 to 10 years? I don't know. But if you've got the ballistic missile, which technology, that's not the expensive part and the fancy part, that's the seeker head. If you get the right technology and the right programming and the right seeker heads, you can make a lot of old dumb missiles be very, very capable and precision targets. That, I think, is one of those, again, little hints that we're getting right now to think about that is either fascinating or terrifying, depending upon which end of the rocket you're sitting on.
Yeah. Boy, something you said just reminded me of, again, a historical lesson, and then that thought flashed and disappeared. I'll come back to it probably. Yeah, I think the concern is that if, and I think you and I have discussed this at some point, you know, if you have stealthy ships, the way to defeat those is you don't have to use radar. You put your, like the Chinese, you put your militia out watching the water, and the militia phones in and says, "Hey, we got a U.S. DDG sitting out here, and gives the coordinates." That's how you beat stealth, and that's how you also don't give away the position of your radars and all that stuff that we would normally try and take out, so we could do whatever we wanted to do. The issue I have, and we've noticed, I know that Sal Vicargliano has noted there's a Iranian merchant, end quote, ship that is drifting along in or out of the Red Sea and seems to be providing information to the Houthis about what possible targets are. You know, and that is the poor man's sophisticated satellite system and everything else. You know, you throw a boat out there and you put some people in it, and they call it in. And I just, you know, we sometimes get too carried away with technology and not think in practical terms of, you know, how do we defeat an enemy who is sophisticated enough to have the missiles, but not too proud to put two guys in a rowboat doing their spotting for them.
Yeah, I think you're exactly right. And how do you counter that? You can't jam that, especially with all the different connectivity going hither and yon. And Lord knows anybody that's done tracking up and down the Red Sea, you can't stop everyone and look at everything. And you also have the cold, hard fact. A lot of our listeners here have done a Suez transit. As you're doing a Suez transit, you're looking up and waving at people in their apartments as you go down towards the Great Bitter Lake. You know, one of those people just has to be paid, you know, about whatever it is, 1,000 Egyptian pounds a month to report every ship that goes by. It doesn't have to be a sophisticated intel gathering when you really have such a relatively small body of water. It's really not that big, but it is, and you know, a lot of folks have made this point. When you look at the impact on the global economy, you look at the expenditure of not too limited, but fairly limited number of precision weapons that, you know, you're likely said, if you don't, you can laugh at, everybody laughs at the flying lawnmower until it impacts your bridge and explodes. Then it's not funny anymore. Everyone has to be taken down. It's amazing the cost to effects ratio that the Houthis and the Iranians are able to execute here on a global scale. You got to tip your hat to them. They, given the deck of cards that they have and the resources they have, they're doing a damn good job. We could learn a few things from them, I think.
Yeah, and one of those things is to identify, and which they've done successfully, identify where your weak links are in your opponent. And if the weak link is the need to have open seas, you know, the Iranians, the Chinese, they're all, you know, they're both, probably the North Koreans for that matter, they're all interested in shutting down open seas. And what does that do to the world economy? Well, they don't really care. I mean, if you're the North Koreans, you got no world economy anyway. And the Iranians, you know, they're sitting on oil, so they think they'll always have something going. But, you know, it's all the choke points. How many times over the last 14 years have we discussed choke points? And I think it's probably at least 4 or 5 times a year. So, that's the key.
And I think anybody who gets a chance, and nowadays you can just Google it, look at the old maps of the British Empire at its height. It wasn't created by accident. And whether you're talking about, you know, Yemen used to be a British protectorate, UAE, the various Emirates there had agreements with the Brits, Singapore, Sri Lanka, South Africa, I mean, even British Guiana, controlling the Great Circle Route coming out of Brazil to Europe, Trinidad and Tobago, Canada for that matter. You look at wherever the British Empire used to be and then overlap where the Chinese Belt and Road is also looking at going to. There's overlap there for a reason, and one of them is what we've been talking about now is access into and out of the Red Sea and also the Persian Gulf, which we also saw last week, something that we mentioned with one of our guests here a few weeks ago that everybody's looking for, you know, where are the Indians? And I forget the name of the ship. When I stop talking here, I'll look over at Sal Marcagliano's TL and dig up the name. But there was a strike on a tanker that caught fire. And my memory serves me right, it was the French and the Indians that were helping out. I think the U.S. may have helped out too. But the Indians actually put one of their firefighting teams aboard the ship. And it wasn't an Indian flagship. It was an Indian. I think the crew was all Indian and Bangladeshi, if memory serves me right. So the Indians have shown the flag, so to speak. They're not shooting down drones or anything, but when you consider how, I don't know if hesitant is the right word, perhaps prudent is a better word. I'll let an Indian expert explain it to me. But they haven't been above the fold in news in the area. But good on the Indian Navy. They belong on the white hat team as opposed to the gray hat team that they seem to be more comfortable playing in.
Yeah, the USS Kearney was involved in helping to put that fire out. The French frigate Alsace and the Indian Navy frigate Visakhapatnam.
Easy for you to say.
They speak English in India, but they name their ships in whatever the other language is. That's the way it's supposed to work. Cooperation at sea, we lend a hand. You notice that somebody's been trying to rehabilitate the Chinese recently and saying that they, and I guess the U.S. has asked them to participate in the Red Sea escorting, and then other people going, well, you know, the Chinese are losing lots of money too because they're losing business, they're losing the revenue from the transportation to Europe, blah blah blah. I don't see them really helping out a whole lot.
Now they're free riding to a certain extent, and I think they are also fairly risk adverse. They've been involved in counter piracy for a very long time. Off of the Horn of Africa. And, you know, Claude Berube has done a great job documenting the number of flotillas they sent out there and come back. They don't do a lot, though. They're mostly using this as an opportunity. For instance, they're building a carrier-capable pier in Djibouti. They're able to collect a lot of intel on how we and other navies operate, including the Japanese, and I think the Indians have been there. I think the Brazilians might actually be commanding it right now. So they're able to steal ideas, see how other people operate, gather intel, but they're not willing to step forward and actually do something that other nations are at least partially doing. It's like the national caveats list for the People's Republic of China is just no. They're here doing their own thing for their own reasons. I guess in some ways you can respect that, but for anybody to call them a responsible player on the international scene, this just underlies the fact that they're not.
Yeah, they've invested heavily in this. I'm here somewhere. They've invested heavily in choke points. You know, they have a different way of doing things than we think about. So they've got a base in Djibouti. They've got stuff they've developed in the Suez Canal area in the Red Sea, investments with Egypt. They have a big interest in the Panama Canal. They've got, they are taking care. They're looking at the Andaman Islands. They're trying to figure out how to eliminate their choke points as much as they can. So, you know, the Chinese and the Indians are at the loggerheads on some of the Andaman Islands. I think they count that Singapore will somehow not participate in trying to shut off the Strait of Malacca if the Chinese do something. But I'm not sure how they know that. You know, they really want Taiwan. For a variety of reasons, but not the least of which is that opens up the first island chain for them. They don't have to try and go through straits that are contested. And their situation is such that they are looking out and probably the same thing that the Brits did, as you point out. I mean, when the Brits had Aden, they also had a partial ownership of the Suez Canal through some various companies until Nasser nationalized the Suez Canal back in 1956, I think it was. You know, they can understand how things work, and yet we're fumbling along. I am totally astonished at the Biden administration's decision not to develop the LNG port that would allow us to provide Europe with natural gas products that would wean them from the need to play with the Russians. And I'm just stunned by that.
When I first read that, I was like, oh, somebody's misinterpreted something. This is, you know, a bad headline writer. And after I read a couple of things, I just, you only get mad about things so often. From not just an energy point of view, but as you mentioned there obliquely, from a strategic point of view, it makes absolutely zero sense. The Europeans are going to have to get that natural gas from somebody. So do we want to have expanded commercial ties with our European allies? Or do we want them once again to get in bed with parties that may not share our view? And money gets you influence. People return your phone calls, and your ability to keep your citizens warm at wintertime at an affordable price gets you even more attention. So, you know, who does that send power to? Qatar, Russia. I don't see any nice, friendly people there that are willing to do that. And it's the wrong people are making decisions for the wrong reasons. As they rack and stack their priorities, that's just not the priority. Elections have consequences. That's international energy, economic/diplomacy/national security interlacing. That's just not one of the priorities.
Yeah, well, it's a priority, but it's a different priority than makes sense in the greater scheme of the bigger strategic game. And, you know, so in order to pander to part of the, you know, I guess a big part of the Democrat Party. I don't know how big the ecological loonies are in that, but you know, in order to pander to them, he's going to do this thing. I don't think he or people who are close to him have, you know, sat down and really weighed the consequences of this. And that's what troubles me more than anything. It was like, you know, some kid goes, oh, you know, this is really bad for the environment. And they immediately respond by, well, then we'll shut it down. And theoretically, since they're now the adults in the room, that's not the way adults usually act.
No, it's not. And energy has to be created in order to have people be housed, fed, and work. And those kilowatts are going to come from someplace. And if it's not natural gas, it's going to be coal. That's really another option. There's a couple of nuclear reactors coming online here and there, but nothing to meet the demand. And there's been a rightfully good investment in using natural gas as a source of energy because it's actually relatively clean for a, quote, fossil fuel, unquote. Coal is not. Our friends in West Virginia would love for the price of coal to go up a fair bit, as would the folks in Kentucky. But I don't see a good explanation anywhere. If any of the listeners out there have seen a good explainer why this is a good thing for the U.S. or anybody else, please let me know. But again, it goes to ideology trumping reason, which I think is what we're looking at, is you have certain constituencies that support you for doing Y, and this has probably got something to do with that. It's, you know, nothing, everything is a compromise, everything is a trade-off, and that's just what we're going to have to see what effects this has at some point down the road. But after the experience with the Russian natural gas, I just can't believe that. I also can't believe what's happened to our strategic petroleum reserve, but it's been depleted for by the same people for the same lack of, again, it's priorities. What can I trade? Can I trade all of this low priority item that I don't understand or care about for a return on unrelated items that are higher up on my constituency's priority list? When you do the math that way, because sadly not everybody agrees with our priority list, I think that's where you get those disconnects. And at some point down the road, it'll have enough negative consequences that somebody else have to come by and clean it up or repair it as best as possible.
Well, when I was in the oil business in Texas, there was a period of time when we spoke a lot about letting the Yankees freeze in the dark. And, you know, apparently the Biden administration has decided they're going to let the Europeans freeze in the dark and see how that goes. I don't, you know, I just don't get it. And it's not, I'm going to end on this. It is not how you treat your friends. You know, you don't promise them you're going to be there for them and then you turn around and walk off, leaving them holding the bag, so to speak.
That's right. Kind of rolling back a bit, speaking of friends, I've been looking for, I haven't dedicated, like I'm going to look at nothing but this for the next hour, but I've been trying to find an answer of all the nations you think would be really interested in having a presence in promoting security in the Indian Ocean. It would be the Australians, but they don't have a big Navy. They can only pick out a few things to do. And they do have a left to center government right now, but I don't think in this arena that really plays into it. Who knows? I'm not an Australian political expert, but when you're looking at designing ships that we've talked about a lot here, the newest Australian, it's a variation of the new British frigate that's coming on board, the Type 26. They're calling it the Hunter class. And it was originally kind of like we talked about before earlier in the show about what you think you're going to need vice what reality tells you you need. And when you are these little navies, like relatively small navies, but what units they have are capable, like the Australians, is when you're invited to the party, you know, do you actually have the right kit to show up and contribute? And a lot of times you can get, we have this problem, and we've talked about the submarine threat many times through the years, and it is a serious threat. And it's kind of a dark art unto itself, and it's helpful to have platforms that are very, very good at it. And the Australians decided their Type 26 was going to be an ASW-focused frigate. Okay, that's great. There are a lot of compromises with it. But interestingly, other people in Australia are looking at what's happened recently and are kind of raising their hands and going, excuse me, because the ship is now looking to displace about 10,000 tons, which is more than a Flight 3 Arleigh Burke, which I know a Flight 2A is a little somewhere north of 9,000 tons, but it's 10,000 tons. Though it was originally even planned to be 8,800 tons. So their Hunter-class frigates are what we would call a destroyer. But it doesn't have, because of what they wanted to do for anti-submarine warfare, they don't have very many VLS cells. And there's this one thing in Defense News by Nigel Pittaway that I just wanted to quote here for a second. This is from the article. Here we go. I want to do a little bit longer than before because it's our show. We have plenty of time. Quote, VLS cells has become a convenient proxy to assess the combat power of warships. By this standard, the Hunter-class frigate's 32 VLS cells fall short of other warships of similar size, Heller told Defense News. The critics' case is that the Hunter is a very poor value for money for such a small number of cells and the resultant combat capability. But it is more complex of an issue than simply numbers, he added. VLS cells are used primarily for air defense missiles and then land strike missiles. The primary role of a Hunter is ASW, anti-submarine warfare. So does it need more than 32 cells? But if the primary role of the Hunter is ASW, why did the Department of Defense require significant design changes that are primarily about enhancing anti-air defense capabilities, unquote. What that just screams out to me is somebody is just really blinkered, not realizing that, you know, you might not be interested in the air threat, but if you're out there doing ASW within range, that air threat's going to be very interested in you.
Yeah, that's right. And, but, you know, that the other side of this is that, and I'm pleased to see that, that the NAVC people, the Rapid Development Group there now has been working with these autonomous vessels, the Ranger and whatever the other one is. You know, they've begun to arm those things. They put some, this is, I know this sounds, doesn't sound like I'm talking to the same thing you're talking about, but they're putting SM-6s and some of these Army long-range missiles on those autonomous boats, and you're thinking, well, okay, that's great, because the, you know, it is a way to get more missiles on scene, create more targets for the bad guys to deal with. And if you do enough of that, if you put enough of those out there, then you can use a vessel like the you know, what are your concerns then of protecting that kind of fleet? And this is where the maybe the Aussies are right. Well, we've got to worry about the submarine threat, somebody spying on where your command ship is. And then the other threat would be somebody from the air. So maybe there's a method to their madness, but I can't guarantee it.
I want to channel my inner Jerry Hendricks here. When you're mentioning that, one thing that clicked in mind is two things. And again, I remain an optimistic skeptic when it comes to unmanned systems, mostly because of we have to get the engineering right. But I could definitely see when you marry the air side of the house's, what do they call it, the loyal wingman concept, where you have the manned platform, but then you have some unmanned ones that are with them. With this is where my Jerry Hendricks come out. The I think he's a big fan of the Honor Harrington series, which is science fiction, where they actually have, you know, space missile barges. That if you had a Hunter class,
me too,
you too, you're a big fan as well. If you have your Hunter class ASW frigate who's going to be going into a hostile environment, or let's say, you know, you've already got your first three holes in the wire in the water 8 years from now, and instead of everybody having Generation 0 or Generation 1 anti-ship ballistic missiles, there's now Generation 3 and 4 out there. You need more anti-ballistic missile capability. Well, we've already demonstrated the fact that we've mastered the quad-packed missiles and the armored box launchers. You can have your Hunter out there with their loyal wingman on either side of them that have a dozen each dedicated anti-aircraft, anti-ballistic missiles that they have the right. I think the issue is they can have the right radar, it's just not have enough VLS tubes. So there's your augment. There's your use of as long as you can stop it from being a leaky electronic warfare target. That's something that in the unmanned systems, I think, at least in the near or the medium term, that's what I would really like to see, is everybody, including, you know, Brian McGrath has been on here yelling about we just don't have enough VLS cells. We can only build Arleigh Burke so fast. But let's go back to our Iranian not-so-much friends, where they've converted a couple of merchant ships into drone and helicopter carriers. Okay, how many Connex boxes full of SM-3s and SM-6s can you strap onto one of those that's been automated that can hang out with your frigates to give VLS cells? I know some people have been talking about that, but I would not think that would be too hard of a concept inside the next POM cycle or two for us with our allies to go out and give it to Third Fleet and said, go play with it. Tell us what's good and bad about it. That I think is a capability gap filler that isn't pie in the sky. It isn't science fiction. It's if you can get the engineering right and you can work the comms issue correctly, which we may have already have, is disclassified. That can give us a comparative advantage because I doubt the Chinese can move that fast.
Yeah, well, I'm not, you know, anybody can develop drone technology for the unmanned aircraft, unmanned vessels. I think, you know, they can, it can be developed pretty quickly. The back in 2009, Wayne Hughes said, you know, there was a discussion about the new, he wrote a piece for the Naval Work at the Naval Postgraduate School on the new Navy fighting machine. Thank you. Yeah, that was a riff on an older piece, the Navy fighting machine, and he proposed that we should have land attack missile ships, each carrying 50 missiles and numbering about 20 inexpensive vessels that can be deployed in pairs or task force. I mean, we just had this discussion last week with our guest about the what he called missile. But his idea was you'd cycle these things in. You'd load up these a ship, doesn't have to be heavily armed, inexpensive. You load it up with missiles. It comes and sits farther away from the from where the action is, but can fire a whole bunch of stuff. And when it's empty, you send an empty, now useless vessel back to be rearmed, and you roll in a new missile ship, and you just keep doing that. And you've got, I mean, if you had 50 missiles on a ship, you got 20 ships, that's 1,000 more missiles. And I think that when Captain Hughes wrote the piece, that was probably the heyday of high tech, that you could get 20 of these things carrying 50 missiles each. I mean, we could probably do a lot more than that, but your risk is that you don't want to overburden this either and have this thing turn into a ship the size of one of these what's the new cruise ship that's just huge? Might as well not even leave port. It's so big.
It's almost like you think it's an AI fake.
Yeah, I mean, I'm just thinking of the radar pictures that thing paints and going, well, I don't think we need quite that big. You know, I would go a little smaller than that, but I want a whole bunch of VLS cells on the thing. And, you know, if it has to be semi-submersible or something, that'd be great, too. I'm sure John Conrad has some thoughts on that. I mean, I don't know what you give up for semi-submersible, but something to keep make it low profile, make it have a whole bunch of VLSs and make it returnable. So it's like, you know, when we used to take Coke bottles back to the store and get our 2 cents, we could buy candy. And these things could be unmanned. I mean, they don't have to have people on them. And that's always the concern.
Optionally manned. You've heard.
Exactly.
A lot of these merchant ships, which I think would be the ideal interim step as opposed to we're going to take 10 years to develop something, very minimally manned. And they don't have – if we're going to be using them as, you know, hey, we would really like for this frigate to have an extra 3 dozen VLS cells. But you know what? You just can't do that in the tonnage. Okay, well, we have these – auxiliaries that can come in optionally manned in case you, for whatever reason, you can't make that happen. They can tuck in behind your destroyers for air defense, but they're not there to hang out forever. They're there to hang out for a certain period of time. And like you said, they go Winchester, they turn around and head east to wherever they need to rendezvous to pick up their crew if they have a crew. And somebody else comes across the horizon ready to check in with the strike group, and there's your extra 3 dozen VLS cells. It's not something that has to be manned 24/7, 365. There's all sorts of ways you could have them in a high readiness state because you don't need them. Yeah, they can have them go out on a Comp 2X or go off on a JTFX or maybe do an exercise with Fourth Fleet now and then. But there's no reason why you couldn't have a few of them in Mayport, Norfolk, San Diego. There's plenty of places around Ford Island you could drop anchor on those puppies. They don't have to have a underway schedule. They just need to be available, kind of like the maritime pre-positioning ships. But they're your place your Connex boxes of missiles stations Alpha through India by in the next 96 hours, get underway in 128 hours type of thing. That is something that we actually, I think, could have done 10 years ago and just waited for the engineering problem and the other issues involving communications and control of these things if we really need to get additional VLS. But I can also hear people say, okay, you've got all these VLSs, but do we have enough weapons in the magazines to put in them? Yes.
If you build it, they will come.
Refill them three or four times, maybe not. But
if you build it, they will come. I think it was Admiral Greenard who talked about payloads, not platforms, and it also talked about and I think he kind of was behind this sort of thinking, you know, that right now we spend are going to spend a whole bunch of money on SSGNs, and that's great. You know, they are pretty much, I mean, obviously they're state of the art, but we could spend a whole lot less money and get a whole lot more VLSs out there, and we have the technology. Obviously, the fact that the Ranger and the other ship are able to carry these things, and we've even put these things on LCSs. Maybe there's a use for those things after all. And, you know, turn them into missile boats. Put VLSs, maybe not VLSs, but the boxes on there. They don't, you know, the Russians have those club missiles that come in a box, and I'm pretty sure you know, they're willing to sell those to a lot of people. So it's not something that's totally unique. And there's no reason for us to always have to go high end. And if it's a matter of, well, you know, we don't want to risk the crew, then, you know, as you say, minimally manned, and make sure that they have some kind of really nice escape capsule should something happen to them, you know, so they can, that if the fear is we're going to lose people because it's an expendable type system, then I think we need to say, okay, well, the unmanned ones we can deal with, the minimally manned we can deal with by providing some kind of, I remember the old B-58 Hustler that had a capsule that the crew ejected in as a whole. I don't know if it worked or not, but
yeah, the F-111 had that too.
Oh, did they? Okay, good.
Yeah, the whole capsule went with you, and the you mentioned the LCS, and most people know my opinion of it. No reason to rehash that. But you're right, especially the Independence class variant. She has that huge deck. If we can't do anything else with it, and it's clear that she really can't defend herself in an environment like the Houthis are providing, but she could tuck in pretty close behind an Arleigh Burke that could give her that extra extended coverage that she would need. And there would be extra capabilities for that Arleigh Burke. And especially if you're going to be hunting dhows or something, or at least doing some, your LCS is allowed to go X distance from your Arleigh Burke, just giving her the top cover to do what needs to be done besides her point defense. So having those VLS cells filled with whatever toys you want to definitely would be a multiplier and would get additional ships out there. But I don't think we're ready to do that anytime in the next two POM cycles. But it would be an interesting concept to do. Again, we used to experiment a lot even when deployed. Get enough duct tape, bailing wire, spot weld those puppies to the deck, give some well caffeinated, over ambitious CO and say, hey, head west, young man, go deploy with this strike group, and then you're going to debrief us when you get back. Tell us what you learned. Why not?
Yeah, Sam LeGrone had a piece on the USNI News, you know, Army long-range missile launcher spotted on Navy littoral combat ship, or littoral combat ship. And, you know, yeah, okay, there's somebody's playing with it. Somebody's out there playing with this concept. Let's just move along faster. We don't have time sometimes you know it'll work, and what you do is sometimes you have to move forward and then discover the glitches later, I think, is what I'm trying to say, you know, because this is something that needs to be played with, and if you're going to train like you're going to fight, this is the time to start playing with it hard and make it work, because it gives the bad guys something else to think about.
You're right, and people should be allowed to fail, too. Yeah, you go out there, and when you debrief, it's like, don't come up and feed the folks of happy talk. Tell them what you learned, good, bad. If it's a great concept, wonderful, let's do more of it. If it doesn't make it past the PowerPoint, you had all these problems, well, at least we figured it out. If it's a combination of the two, then we can fix it. We've done this before, but some of it's analysis paralysis. There's also, you know, this isn't my idea. This doesn't have a program. But again, that's all self-imposed constraints on our own action, which is fixable if we wanted to. But it's what we've been joking about recently, problem appreciation. It's fun to appreciate the problems. This some variation of what we've been talking about in that regard. It would solve not all, but more of the problem that we have than what our plans are right now. I just saw a note from our good friend Southern Air Pirate. He brought up a picture of the old Battlecruiser 2000, which was the Arsenal ship, which had 8,352,000 VLSLs on it.
Oh yeah,
but I remember that Arsenal ship. Yeah,
yeah. Well, it was I think Greenert called the thing a missile. God, I just had it a second ago. A missile truck, you know. Sure, missile truck. Good idea. Let's do it.
It wouldn't hurt too much, but hey, I just realized we've already gone past an hour. As usual,
people are gonna miss the NFL playoff games if they haven't. They missed the first one probably.
Yeah, they pretty much have. But thought I'd let the listeners know that we're taking next week off, but we'll be coming back in a couple of weeks. I believe we're going to have Dr. John Kuhn, I can never pronounce his name right, from the Army War College. He's been on a few times before. We're still broadly looking at what we're going to talk about. But we had our prior guest, Jeff Vandenagel, that was with us last week talking about the carrier. There's been a bunch of talk back and forth with how the carriers have been working off of Yemen recently as well. But there's a track record here that is interesting. Everybody talks about carriers being vulnerable. That's not new. And he's actually done a lot of research, and part of his recent book actually looks at the period in the first half of the Second World War in the Pacific that a lot of people forget about, is the fact that, we had one carrier, in some ways zero carriers, and we were fighting in the Pacific anyway. But we figured that would be an interesting time to talk about some of the realities of contested space in the Pacific. So hopefully 2 weeks from now, we'll be back with John.
Yeah, look forward to it. And I hope everybody has a good luck with their NFL playoffs and the rest of their lives.
Yep, and I hope everybody is having a great Navy Day. Until next time, cheers.
To the It's a long, long way to Tipperary.